Yeah, so I just destroyed that couch. Saw that the neighbor's in construction. And so I thought I had like a little handsaw tree trimmer, I thought, and I couldn't find it. I was like, let me go get Peter's. And my wife was very much like, I want this done now. Like, we have to get that thing gone. And so our neighbor's in construction. And she just texted his wife. He's like, can I borrow a saw real quick? He has to, saw a couch in half. And she's like, sure. And then he brings over, it's a electric saw, like a handheld.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I got it. It still took about 4 to 5 minutes to saw the couch in half. But yeah, I felt pretty good, actually, when I was done. I felt like I accomplished something.
Did you do it by yourself, or did you have the pressure of the neighbor watching you?
No, it was by myself.
Okay, good. Okay. So
it's kind of amazing I didn't hurt myself.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It got away from me a couple times. It's just like you push the trigger and it goes.
The saw did?
Yeah, the saw, and because it's a couch, there's all metal bungees. There were some sparks that went sometime. Like, what if I catch this thing on fire? So it's amazing. I still have all my fingers and limbs.
Can we give backstory to what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. About a week ago, Matt and I hang out sometimes off the podcast, and sometimes we don't talk about books. His wife had asked him to move some furniture around in the house. There was this very large couch upstairs that needed to be taken down to his garage. And we
like bulky large, not like, don't think long, think is a love seat size, two cushions, okay. But just bulky.
Like one of those things where the cushions don't come off and they kind of, they look like they should bend it, like they should be pushed in around corners of door frames and such, but they don't.
Yeah, and very large armrests, like big, puffy, over a foot long armrests. Yes. So, anyway, sorry.
And we attempted, I would say, for a good 30 minutes.
At least.
At least. We got it at one point wedged into the sort of, not really a hallway per se, but sort of connects a couple rooms. It's a hallway, I guess. And dripping sweat. It was great workout. Kind of messed up some of your door frame a little bit.
I drilled the door. I had to take the door off its hinges.
I preemptively took some photos down because I could see us destroying those. Needless to say, at one point, Matt got a large axe and I could just see your wife coming home and seeing that and not being cool with, like, hey, why Peter's over here and he you guys have the axe out, you're good. And I was like, maybe we shouldn't use the axe in my head.
Eventually. Yeah, I was just, the couch was not moving. It was upstairs and we were trying to get it downstairs to the garage and we just could not go any further.
No.
And I got fed up. I was like, I'm going to break this thing up.
I was asked questions like, how did you, and even if we got it out of the little hallway area, we still had to go down some steps, which was going to be even more questionable.
Yeah.
Because if we had gotten farther along, I don't know if we could have gotten back into the room.
And then we just have a couch on steps.
Then we just have a couch on steps.
Yeah.
Not good. But we moved. I helped move some other stuff.
Yeah, and I feel bad because I told you, and I forgot how much of a pain that couch is because it's just been there for 4 years. But I told you it's like it'll be 10 minutes with just like four or five things real quick. And everything else is real quick, but that couch, I don't remember how I got it up there. It's amazing it fit.
It's baffling.
I might have taken the railing off its edges, but that still doesn't explain how I got it.
Doesn't explain how you even get to the railing.
It was just a big bulky couch that I could not move.
So back to the handsaw. What are we, did you have a plan to, where are we taking off the arms first? How did you just go, I'm cutting?
I turned it upside down. I got a utility knife and cut the bottom off just to see the lay of the land.
Yeah, see what we got.
Really solid wood is kind of a shame. I actually kind of wouldn't have minded keeping that couch. I kind of liked it, but I didn't have
Yeah.
Relationship capital. I didn't feel like
making. Yeah, that couch had to go.
Yeah,
it's a nice couch, but it had to go.
Yeah, I tried one last time. I was like, man, we really just can't get the couch out. Do you want to maybe just keep it? And it was just really quick, before I even finished my sentence. Just, no.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, I agree.
Let me get a saw.
We might disagree on where the crawdad sings, but your wife and I are agreement. That couch had to go, man. That couch had to go.
Yeah. And it's gone. And it was kind of it felt really virile.
I was worried. The springs, those are kind of drawn mm-hmm. pretty tight in there. Were you afraid one was going to fly out and hit you and impale you and maybe, you know, a little, you know, rush to the emergency room? And then you have to explain to the ER how you got impaled by a couch spring that you were sawing up in your house?
I wasn't too worried about the springs. I was worried about I put shoes on.
That's good. That's good.
Like I say, I was trying to be very careful with the fingers. I didn't want a big gash in my thigh. Power saw. What do you call it? Like, I'm really glad I didn't use like a wood saw, like with my hands out. It'd take it forever. But basically, I get upside down and there's a bunch of springs, but I attack the edges, the frames, with the really solid wood. And then, like, I get them like a cut in the middle, and then I kick it. Which is pretty fun, and it like snapped in two, and so I was gradually, and I didn't have to disassemble the whole. I just had to cut it in half to where I could take it down the stairs.
Where is it now?
It's out. There's a part of our backyard that's not visible. I don't want to sound like trashy. You know what I mean?
I know what you're talking about.
Off to the right of the house.
Everybody's got a part of the yard where they can just store stuff. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. There's. It's not visible to the public. It's behind a fence. I can't store it in the garage because the kid's out there sometimes. And I didn't want to spring it like a sod and half couch. So it's there until we do our next dump run.
Yeah. Take me on the dump run. I love going to the dump. They moved it. I got to go to the dump.
Okay. Well, we'll do a dump run together.
Nice.
We'll probably get rid of that couch before it snows. Or just leave it there for the next person that lives here. I don't know. Should I salvage the wood? It was pretty solid wood. Should I salvage it for firewood? Or can you not?
Ooh.
Maybe I'll salvage the wood and get rid of the other stuff.
We might have to take a look at that. Yeah, because you do have a nice fireplace.
Maybe I'll salvage the wood.
I'm trying to save your home by making it sound. It's a nice house, but you do have a nice, like, what kind of fireplace is that? It's kind of,
Wood stove.
It's not really a fireplace. It's a wood stove.
Yeah, it's a pellet burner.
Pretty fun adventures, though, Matt. Pretty fun.
It was fun. I was proud of myself. I felt very accomplished.
Did your son just go, good job, Dad?
No, he was fascinated with the saw.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's dangerous. But
okay. Well, he wasn't in the room with me. He wanted to see it, and I was like, you need to take him out. But the next morning, I had already returned the saw, and he came in. He's like, do you want to see the saw? He's like, very fascinated. Like, you can't look this body.
Proud of you, man. Proud of you. It's almost like, I don't know what I was going to say, but I'm just proud of you. You sent me a picture mid-disassembly. I was like, oh, whoa.
That was from the next. I took a few pictures. That was the day after.
So you succeeded.
It was in the evening.
You should have taken that picture. Then the next picture should have been like the ER, and you just like your fingers covered, wrapped up, and like.
If I were more of a practical joker, I would have Google image searched like somebody's bloody fingers and then sent it to you, and you'd have been like, "Oh my god!" And then like, "Wait, why is he?"
And then I would have been nonchalant, and then my wife would have asked me, "Oh, how does Matt?" Ah, Matt was cutting the couch up, and he cut his finger. And then she would be like, what? I'd be like, I think he's fine. I don't know. He texted me. It's totally good.
I'm sure it's a joke. I don't know why he bothered to text.
I don't, if he lost a hand, he might have trouble reading books in the future, but I think he's good. I think he's fine. I like that.
You'd have trouble holding him, I think.
Yeah. Might have to go full on Kindle. Might be a Kindle guy now.
Nah, never.
Just audio. Anyway. I think on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and cutting up couches. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Matt, good job. Quick question I had to ask for you too. You posted this over on the Instagram. Follow us over there. Did you go book buying?
I bought some more books on a whim. Did you see what I got?
Yeah, you got some stuff that I'm familiar with. One I'd read, one I have. It's been on my bookshelf for a while.
Yeah.
Buddenbrooks.
The Thomas Mann. I don't know. I was kind of in the mood. He's been popping up in my ancillary reading. I was like, let's get not next month, not this month, not October.
Oh, we can't read Magic Mountain and
But maybe November, December.
Why don't we just add now? Do you want to read Magic Mountain?
We could do Button books actually.
That's even longer, I think.
Yeah, they're all.
There was a great comment that Magic Mountain. I think it was in talking about Magic Mountain, saying they got a copy of that book, but the font is so small. And I know exactly what they're talking about. There's a edition of the Magic Mountain I had read in college. Kind of only reason why I finished that book. And the font is so small. And you would read for like an hour and you would get 30 pages done. It was the print was just tiny and it's just dense, compact. And you know, it's like you're having to use your brain and it's not like quick, it's not, you know, Lions Lucerne here. It's the Magic Mountain. And I related very much to that comment.
To that, yeah. Got a lot of feedback. A lot of people
respond. A lot of feedback.
I was surprised.
Almost as if we should, you know, maybe my nomination should actually, I can't complain too much because one of my nominations is tonight's focus. So
you win a lot. But not maybe November, December.
We have so many books. We can't say that.
Yeah, we're just going to do it.
We're going to do it.
But we won't add it for October. Yeah, we'll get into it later. I was going to get into translations, but let's keep it moving.
Oh, get more. Oh, I like
which that. Translation?
Oh, okay.
As I was buying it, there were two different versions, and I noticed they had different translators. So I was like, all right, let me find. And there were one is mass market, one is trade paperback. Not important. Anyway, I found like the beginning of a chapter and read the first paragraph. And was like, okay, which am I more comfortable with if I'm going to sit and read this 500 page book at some point? So which, and that's how I chose. I chose the more expensive one because it's a little more modern feeling translation.
If you're going to buy wine, do you go cheap or do you go expensive?
Cheap. I can't tell the difference between.
I like that.
If I'm buying. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's transition over to the main subject tonight, Matt. And that is The Sun by Philip Meyer. We had previously read early on in the podcast, if I'm not mistaken, American Rust, the debut Philip Meyer, a novel we both loved. You had read The Sun before.
I'd read The Sun right when it came out. 10 years ago now.
Came out 2013, 10 years ago. American Rust was 2009. This has been on my shelf on my TBR for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I nominated it on a whim, thinking that we wouldn't pick it for a monthly selection, but we did. And I'm very glad that we did. It's got, you know, the blurbs are very good on the back. If you're not familiar with the book, it makes it sound like, you know, Meyer's sort of like a Cormac McCarthy-esque author. And in some ways, I guess he is. I would argue, and we can kind of get into this later, he's not, I find more Hemingway than McCarthy with him. I find it much more, I don't know, realistic is the term, but there seems to be something more that you can grasp onto in both novels that we've read of his, and it's not so describing the trees and the landscape, and
it's more, and this is without being patronizing because Philip Meyer is a great writer, but it's more readable Sutri, which is not, I like both.
It's completely different books, but I think it's a little easy just to say, you know, this is a Western book, takes place in Texas, you know, in the 1800s and all the way, you know, the novel's, you know, grand in sort of its time, like how long of time the novel takes place. But it seemed like a little easy to sort of say, oh, this is kind of like for fans of Cormac McCarthy or such. You could... you could make a connection. So, you know, fans of this would probably like that, but that might just be more the genre of the book.
I think it's because it's a violent Western, and Blood Meridian was a violent Western. I think that's why people reach for that.
And I would say the beginning of the book has some of the most vivid and McCarthy-esque sort of imagery. There's a kind of, I'll do a kind of a synopsis of the plot here. Not an easy book to do a quick synopsis of the plot, but basically it is a family drama with sort of the head figure of Eli. Why am I blanking on the last name?
McCullough.
And his story begins sort of in the middle of the 50s.
He's born in 1836.
And sort of the starts with a Comanche raid on his house, and his mother and sister are brutally murdered. His brother is eventually killed. His father is like away. And it's sort of that starts the story of how he is sort of captured by the Comanches and sort of taken into this specific tribe and lives. While that story is going on, you get sort of a look at the family tree of Eli. His son, Peter, who is, for me personally, a fascinating character, not just because I have the same name, but he is sort of the opposite of his father, right? The book does a very good job of presenting a case where how families work is often, the conflict of families is usually, a powerful head figure, and then sort of the offspring doesn't match up with that figure, or like maybe one or two, sons kind of look up to the father. Peter's not one of those people. He sees a lot wrong with his dad. There's a kind of an incident with a family, the Garcia family, correct?
Yeah, the neighboring ranchers.
That scene is early on in the book where they sort of massacre this family. No other way to put it. So those two scenes are kind of at the beginning of the novel. They are the most McCarthy-esque. And from there, it really, I felt, becomes more of like a focus on the family, a focus on almost like an American look at America or Texas at this sort of very fascinating, pivotal time in American history, or even Texas history, where it's, expansion West, whites, Native Americans, Mexicans, all this sort of kind of boiling up into just violence and betrayal and greed and money and power. And all these things are in the novel, and it's hard to just pinpoint one thing about the book, like, oh, it's about this, or it's about, there's a lot of different things. How else would you kind of summarize, without giving away too much of the book?
Big sweeping American epic, violent.
Yeah, almost like the continent too of North America, realistic, in a way, yeah. Right?
Just kind of how it ebbs and flows. Everybody's taking each other's land, mm-hmm. and it's unfortunate, but that's kind of just how it works. And we should say the narrative structure is, it's young Eli McCullough with his family on the frontier to being kidnapped by the Comanches, mm-hmm. to returning to white civilization. But it's interspersed, that through narrative is throughout the book, but it's interspersed. It's like, the next chapter mm-hmm. is his son, Peter McCullough, in like 1914, 1915.
Journal entries.
His journal entries, and Eli is an old man. Mm-hmm. And then the third character is Jeannie McCullough, the great-great-granddaughter of Eli. And she is at the ranch, has kind of shifted into being, they found oil. And so she's a really rich oil magnate. And she's like the last McCullough before, before everything falls apart. That's another big theme that I kind of want to get into later. You mentioned it. You alluded to it too. In empires or kingdoms, there's usually the big conqueror, like Cyrus from Persian mythology or Saul from the Bible. And then you get one or two more generations of maybe worthwhile, strong enough kings before everybody gets kind of lazy and spoiled and it falls apart. That's another big part of this. But anyway, so there's three, and Jeannie McCullough is like the last of the gritty, tough frontier McCulloughs. And she is, you get it, she's kind of passed out. You get the sense she's dying, and it's her recollections as a, she's an old woman in like 2012-ish.
Yeah.
Looking back on her life. So you get this whole span.
The book's like almost 200 years of
yeah. And it's significant. Eli mentions he is the first male Texan born after they get independence from Mexico. So his birthday in 1836 is significant because that's right after.
Oh, yeah.
It's the Alamo and San Jacinto and when Texas is an independent. So that's the kind of symbolism there. And so you get the whole, and his great granddaughter is an oil magnate. And it's kind of just the history of America, frontier, Texas.
And also, I saw it as sort of how the McCulloughs are maybe a stand-in for maybe you could say America. I had a question that I was gonna do later on, but I can do it now. Like, if you were to write a college paper about this book, what would your angle be? Because there's so much, and the great thing about this book is there's so many different ways you can go, right?
Yeah. I might I might delve into what I just mentioned, the generational conqueror thing, because we're reading the King David report too. Mm. And it kind of, and I checked in with my brother who knows about this stuff earlier today. there is the kind of like three or four generations from a conqueror to when the empire or kingdom declines because all the kids get spoiled and lazy. And that's a huge, in The Sun at the very end, there's that kid from Mexico who's Peter McCullough's. He's not illegitimate, but it's like they don't, the white McCulloughs don't recognize him. And he's hungry and ambitious, and all Jeannie's kids are kind of lazy and just want nothing to do with it. And so, and you get the sense like he's the next. Anyway, but anyway, that's like one kingdom grows fat and lazy, and then the ambitious, hungry people from outside the borders are coming in to take it. That's what I'd focus on. And I'd probably draw comparisons to King Saul, King David, Solomon, and then apparently the king after Solomon, the kingdom of Israel went into civil war and got wiped out and was never a kingdom again. So that's kind of like I do some sort of comparison with that.
It's a, I don't know, it's just so fascinating. It's a great kind of, I don't know, way of telling a story is just to have this the rise of this family.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing much at the beginning, and just like for him to expect like that his family would continue on, for it's just like unrealistic in my mind when you're reading the book, because he's just a very unique person, Eli. Like his story,
he's the conqueror.
For him to like keep going, and in many ways, I feel like Jeannie is very close to him because she kind of
was, yeah.
It's very subtle, but she is extremely wealthy. Like she has a Gulfstream at the very end. Like she has, and it's funny because it kind of ebbs and flows, right? Like her father was sort of unaware. He's not really a main figure in the book. And it's something to get into. Like Meyer kind of, it's interesting how he chooses which characters to focus on. And if I had to ask him a question, I'm like, how did you figure out who was going to be the important like narrator voice? Because in my mind, this could easily be spread out more, right? Instead of three kind of voices or, you know, different perspectives, it could have been, you know, 5, 8 different voices, because there's, you know, there's enough characters for that. But it's just like a fascinating look at the ebbs and flows of a dynasty family, right?
Yeah.
Better word. And how by the end of it, you just feel like, is Meyer saying that just like the all great dynasties or families or nations like will eventually decline? Because that's sort of the theme of the book is like Mexico or Native Americans have the land. They are, you know, ruthlessly taken out. Mexico kind of takes over, you know,
and Mexico was ruthless with
the
to live there in the 1500s. And then in Peter's chapter, the McCulloughs are ruthless to the Mexicans when they take over their ranch on kind of a pretext. There's a pretext like that their ranch hand stole horses, which may or may not be true, but Eli almost doesn't care. He's just like, we're gonna
take it. And sort of the ethos of the family haunts Peter for like the rest of his life.
Peter is the moral voice. Peter doesn't agree. Like, Eli has been through so much and been raised in two different violent cultures and had everything he loves stripped from him twice. And he just kind of doesn't, he's doing what it takes to survive. And so, his son Peter is the moral voice, doesn't agree with his father, but he somehow can't get away. I have here in my notes, I'm curious what you think of this. Mm-hmm. Peter McCullough as Lily Bart from House of Mirth, because they're both kind of not fitting in with the world that they exist in. Peter eventually gets away, but he's intellectual, he's sensitive, he has a moral core, and he's just surrounded by all this violence, and he's not cut out. He loves the world, he likes the work of being running a ranch, working with horses and cattle and all that, living the land, but he can't ignore all the violence and stuff that goes with it, and he likes to read, and it's just not, he's not cut out for that world, but he can't leave at the same time.
And it's I don't know, I love the fascinating like difference between everybody sort of in the book, because Eli at the peak of his powers, right, is seemingly unstoppable, right? And you would think with a character like him, he could be able to control his sons, but he's sort of lost control of Peter, and it makes for this dynamic which is sort of simmering, and a lot of what Peter feels is very internal. Like, Peter is just very much in his own head throughout most of the book.
Yeah.
And there's some just, great scenes of like dialogue with conflict about, what Peter wants to do with his life versus what his father wants him to do.
His father wants him to be more ruthless and go for the jugular like he did. Yeah. And he just can't. There's a great little line when Peter and Eli are talking. And Peter doesn't know this, but we know it because we're privy to what happened when Eli and his brother Martin were kidnapped by Comanches. Martin was intellectual and kind of eager to get out of the frontier and go to East Coast to college. Anyway, Eli says to Peter, you think I don't sabe, but I do. My brother was just like you. Remember that?
Yeah.
It's like, Peter's like, yeah, whatever. But you know, the reader, you're like, no, it's,
In some ways you can't really blame Eli for how he is. Like, that, to have survived, he had to,
become... He saw his family murdered in front of him.
Yeah.
But picking up by the Comanches. And just a wonderful, realistic, accurate depiction of Comanche life that we're treated to in the book. But he takes to the Comanches and he kind of enjoys the freedom of riding with them. And then they all die of smallpox. And he has to come back to the white settlements. And so he's seen everything stripped away from him twice, and he kind of pours all his ambition into his ranch and becomes a pretty just ruthless rancher.
And it's Meyer does such a great job of, there's just so much push and pull and tension with everything in all these characters' lives. Like, there's backstabbing, there's just, no one trusts anybody, and it's hard work. And I don't know, it just, all that tension, and just, he's a fantastic writer, like, just from a, sentence by sentence, describing stuff, developing characters, all that stuff. So it's just a pleasure to sort of read. What were your thoughts on Jeannie, as far as, because she's sort of an interesting, she's almost like, what is she, three? She's the great-great-granddaughter of Eli.
Fourth generation.
She's the granddaughter of Peter? No.
Peter's granddaughter. She didn't really know Peter. Her dad isn't focused on as much, but he's kind of a not borderline silly. He's like a right in between when the ranch was still making a lot of money, but obviously not viable in the future. right before they become really oil rich, her dad was like just kind of a rich dilettante, pretend to be a cowboy, but he's a rich kid. And he's kind of like that third generation. And then Jeannie's just the last, really, she's the last vestige of the frontier mentality. And it's not really, she's kind of a, she's an interesting character. She's kind of flawed a little bit. She has some old prejudices, but they make sense for somebody who came from where she did. In the end, I think, and I don't want to give too much away, but I think fear kills her in the end, almost like literally, if you remember that scene.
Yeah.
Why she's passed out on the floor, like what causes it.
Yeah, there's a kind of the end of the book kind of reveals some stuff about how the story's taking place. It's really kind of fascinating. But she almost, in the same way that Eli had to grow and develop into who he became, and Eli's not a good person. Let's just, like, if as we're reading them, you don't sort of root for anybody, but it's like, you know, it is what it is, the story and sort of the what the characters do. But she's sort of pushed that way because, for me at least, it's sort of the disadvantage of being like a woman and growing up in this sort of harsh environment. And I thought it was interesting how he sends her off to sort of the East Coast to sort of be like, go to school, do all this stuff. And she kind of rejects it. It comes back and becomes this wildly successful, you know, elevates the family wealth to, but at what cost, sort of the book asks at the end, like, what is all
her
this
family money? Basically
her, yeah, her family, but you know, that the next, her kids, and then eventually you don't really get her grandkids, but like, it's just interesting how the family sort of not disintegrates, I don't think that's not the right word, but the interest of each generation doesn't seem to align, or is, you know, won't always align with sort of the figurehead, right?
Well, yeah, it can't be. You get soft. The things that shaped Eli McCullough is a very harsh, kill or be killed environment. And he passed it, his son, his two sons. There's a, Peter has a brother, Phineas, who's actually more in line with Eli. He's a very capable, but he's more of a civilized backroom power broker, right? And so that he's, and then Peter's the moral voice, and you have a third generation, Jeannie's dad, who's a rich dilettante who likes pretending to be a cowboy. And then Jeannie is able to survive in kind of the rough and tumble oil men world of the 40s, 50s, 60s, because I think she grew up, she knew Eli McCullough, they call him the Colonel throughout the book. She knew the Colonel for the first 10 years of her life, and she absorbed that ethos. And that's kind of why she is a woman who's able to hang in there, I think. And then she's like the last of it. Her kids were kind of soft and spoiled, and she got to see her grandkids a bit, but they're just, she says flat out, like, they're just so far removed from everything she grew up with. And I think that's the way of, that's one of the things I do think he's getting at, is it's just, that's just the way empires and kingdoms go.
I was going to ask you, where do you think he stands on this, Meyer?
Meyer?
Because now one thing, I think he's criticizing it, but on the other side, I think he's making the point that it is true. Like,
it's,
you do need hardship to sort of, like, a hard edge to keep growing. If that makes sense. If you're just like living fat, as a, you know, so to speak, like, you know, rich and wealthy and no worries, then that edge is like almost certainly going to go away. So
I'm rich,
it's just, and I couldn't quite figure out where I landed, or, you know, trying to decide where he lands sort of in the book, or, you know, what's, I don't want to say he's siding one way or the other, but.
Well, let me ask you, how much does it matter?
Because that's a good question. Yeah.
I think his point is, or one of the points of the book is, like, this is just what happens. Like it or not, it's very violent, and people take each other's land all the time. And just, it is kind of is what it is. And if he's kind of just trying to show you, you know, this is just how it goes. I mean, of course, I think, of course, you would deplore violence and you don't want to be associated with it or have it happen to anybody that you love. But at a certain point, what is, like, taking a stand against the violence get you?
Yeah.
Or what? I mean, of course, of course, it's awful. But I mean, as a novelist, like, how to, do you need to take a stand, or are you just trying to depict the world as it is?
I know. Yeah, that's a good point. because there's a great, the final scene in the book of sort of the kid chasing him and like
Chasing Eli.
Yeah,
and maybe he hunts me still.
Yeah, and yeah, he's worth, you know, I can't remember the number. I just looked it up, like he's worth 20,000 men today or something. Just sort of,
oh, just the competence of,
yeah, just sort of the determination and seemingly, I mean, the part of the book where Eli is just sort of in the Comanche, we kind of touched on briefly, but it's just a fat, like it's fascinating reading. It's brutal. It's like it's a very well done aspect of the book.
The Eli part, the young Eli parts are like my favorite. They're just so fascinating. Just how the Comanches lived, what they ate.
Yeah.
Some of the scene where he's describing what they did with the buffalo, like tearing the gallbladder and use it as like a condiment.
And that's where it gets a lot into like American history, sort of. And it's never, he's never like overt. Like even the scenes where they come upon like smallpox that's just decimated and killed, you kind of have to be like, he's not, doesn't hold your hand, so to speak. You have to be like, oh, I think they have smallpox. Okay. And then it's just
a brutal
description of disease that has just ravaged, you know, this, you know, proud tribe. But those sections are that might also be where you get the McCarthy reference, I think.
Yeah.
Because I don't think McCarthy does the family drama.
No, I really do think it's a violent Western, and then Blood Meridian's a violent Western. I really do think that's the McCarthy. That's where the McCarthy stuff comes from.
References the TV show The Wire. I'm like, I don't, that seems kind of weird.
Maybe just the different points of view. Could almost do, it's not quite Lonesome Dove, but want to talk about big epic Westerns with flawed but likable characters. Eli's a likable character. He's not a moral person, if you want to break it down, but he's pretty likable. You like his chapters. You like being in his head.
Because I think the tendency would be Eli's the more interesting, charismatic, flawed, obviously, character. And Peter's sort of the wet blanket. But I still think Peter's is written in a way that you can take a lot from him.
I liked his chapters. It's all, they're all good. And Peter's not wrong.
There's a great part where he like, at the very end, he kind of imagines like killing his father. And then when the actual like reality of that hits he's just like, he's shaken that he would actually consider that. And that's a good description of him. Like he kind of imagines things in his head that he'll say or do. And then when the time comes, he's kind of scoffs at that. Although he kind of, you know, he does kind of pick up and
makes his break at the end.
Yeah. Makes his break and steals money from the family. He steals money from the family, correct?
Yeah, or he takes. I mean, it's
takes it out.
He takes it and runs off. It's a good little storyline, and he finally gets out, and because he's all caught in his own thoughts, right? He has morals, but at a certain point, it's not really. He's hanging around the ranch where the stuff he deplores happens. At what point it's like you have to walk away? You like it here, but you gotta make your break if you're gonna live up to your ideals. I think that's part of his drama too. But I don't know. I have written here, bookish people aren't cut out for the harsh frontier life. And Eli, well, Peter and Eli's brother Martin, you kind of get that sense. It's just kind of.
I also liked. I didn't know. I couldn't really develop too much of like how this fits in with the book, but there are, you know, kind of the important wars in America are sort of not, you know, main points of the book, but they are sort of, they change the direction of the family, you could argue, because certain brothers die. Kind of World War One, World War Two. Jeannie's brother too. I think two of Jeannie's brothers die. So it sort of makes a connection to America at large, how this McCullough family fits in. So I don't know. I couldn't come up with too much more, but I kind of enjoyed that sort of those benchmarks and fitting in the McCullough story. What else, Matt?
Well, kind of while I'm looking at it here, while we're talking about what the decline and fall of empires, did you catch that last scene we were referencing?
I was going to say, yeah, there's something that's a little on the nose, a little bit.
The shield stuffed with.
Yeah.
But that's kind of like what. So the whole, what Peter was talking about, you, Peter, not Peter McCullough, with the one guy was worth 20,000 of. We know Eli had a wife, like Peter and Phineas's mother. Mm. He had another oldest son that's referenced, but he's not around in the later chapters, and his wife isn't around. And there's some tension between Peter and his dad about what happened to his mom. And you're kind of like, we get resolution on that, and it's I'm gonna ruin it, but it's Apaches come and kill. So Eli's like, that's what happened. Then Eli's going out and chasing the Apaches that killed his family, and he's capable of catching up with them because of his past or whatever. And so they kill all the Apaches that killed Eli's family, but they leave one alive. And then that's kind of one of the Apaches' shields is stuffed from a previous raid. The Apache has made it stuffed with an old book. And Eli finds that it's Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is, you know, it's on the nose, but it's, you know, if you're wondering, like, did he intend it to be like that? It's like, yeah, I think so. But anyway, but that's like an old 100-year-old Eli is reminiscing. It's like that one Apache guy is worth 20,000 modern day people.
Yeah. It's like, I think it's, I don't know. It's interesting. Like the later generations, I almost feel like they don't really give two thoughts to sort of their great great grandfather, even though he was so important, sort of setting up the family. Because I was thinking about myself, like I don't have a real connection that far back, I would think most people wouldn't. Maybe, you know, certain families are different, obviously, but it struck me as I was reading the book how quickly sort of the importance or grandeur of a person's life can kind of just disappear after seemingly not that long of a time. You would think that the kernel, so to speak, would live on forever in a way, but kind of doesn't.
That's kind of the way things, right? Well,
kind of ends with Genie in a way, and that's not going to really come back. I feel like the book says once it's gone, it's gone. Like,
you know, the dynamic, that
influence is gone, it's sort of gone.
Yeah, but you notice the dynamic continues. Like the actual Eli McCullough as a person, like that'll kind of go away.
Yeah,
but like the kid from Peter's.
I see what you're saying.
The thing with Genie, he's the new Eli. He's the new dynamic. He's full of ambition. He's going to Mexico City. But that's kind of the point. Like, the ambition will go away and new empires will be forged. But it's cyclical.
New families will rise to, like, sort of.
Exactly.
You know, talking about families, and you can, you know, expand that to.
You expand it to culture.
Countries and cultures and sorts of things.
I think history is cyclical like that. There's different cultures. Anyway, we could get into that whole thing, but it's to look at things more cyclical rather than linear, like a continuing progress towards something versus, you know, it's a life cycle of a dynasty, of an empire, of a kingdom, of a culture. It's like a butterfly or something, you know. It's got its own little lifespan, and it's a caterpillar. It hibernates, blooms, and then it's gone.
You're very good, very poetic of you.
Yeah,
butterfly. Second time through, did you like it more? Did you same? Did you notice anything different? Oh, yeah. Or
I picked up on more of the symbolism.
Okay,
Gibbon in the shield. What else? Book, yeah, the Peter McCullough's Lily Bart, I was proud of. Bookish People Not Cut Out for Frontier Life.
There's a reference to kind of later on in the book. I didn't know if it was, oh God, what was it? It almost seemed like he sort of made a reference to a business deal that Jeannie didn't go through with Halliburton or something. And I was like, is that the Halliburton?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? I was like, is that, so, are we in? No, does that make sense?
No, I got that. It was, so it used to be Kellogg Brown, and then it's Kellogg Brown and Root. And then I think that got bought up by Halliburton.
Okay.
Oh, there was fun to Lyndon Johnson. She's bankrolling young Lyndon Johnson's Senate campaign. As just a little aside, I like that. There's a little bit of subtle references to when Kennedy's assassinated. She kind of makes it seem like some of her oil buddies. She's like, oh, they did it. I enjoyed that. Just a subtle little
flushing out of the story, yeah.
Yeah, well, because she's a Texas oil person. I liked he took a little swipe at the academics, I thought. There's a, was it Jeannie, Peter? Somebody's meeting with a historian talking about, it was Peter meeting with his, who was it? Well, somebody's meeting with a historian and talking about who's writing a book about the family.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he just kind of, as an aside, is like, the historian looked like he was about to apologize for breathing. He's so subservient and a lot of academics.
I know. I like it. It's interesting because I loved American Rust, and it feels like he sort of built on American Rust and not sort of, they're not, I don't think, they're kind of similar, I guess, in some ways. They're kind of both, you could argue, both sort of depressing in different ways. This is much grander. This is, you could almost say, when you think of like the quote unquote great American novel, which people always talk about, you know, for decades and centuries and whatever, this seems like, I don't think it's really possible. And I don't really like the term the great American novel, but when you talk about a novel that tries to, with themes that are very much in the American consciousness of like what it means, like, you know, you read an Irish novel, you get a sense of like Irish history and stuff like that, so on and so forth. I feel like this book, you kind of get a sense of like America's past history, where it heads towards all those sort of things. Do you think that's fair to say?
Well, I was doing my research, just reading about him and how he, or Philip Meyer, how he conceives of this. And it made it seem like, A, he's working on a third book, but it seems like he sees it, American Rust, The Sun, and his new one as kind of a loose trilogy about the American experience. I don't think he used that term, but it's kind of a loosely, it's about America and what that involves to be an American, American history. I do think what you're saying, everyone talks about the great American novel. Has it been written?
Yeah.
Yet to be written. And I think the mistake there is people talk like there's only one. And I think it's like there's 20, 30. Moby Dick, it's, you know. But I think this is one. This is one of them. This is of the teens. This is, if you want to talk about, just split it up. I think sometimes A Great Notion is a great American novel. Right? I think...
I was actually thinking of that book while reading this, just the family dynamic.
Family epic that kind of gets
to some similarities too.
But I think this is a great American novel. If you go with my premise of there's not just one, there's many, and this is one of them. This would be the great American novel of the 2010, of the teens, I think. The best one I've read so far of that era.
And this doesn't apply to like every sort of where you could classify that. I think a lot of like the through line to some of these novels is like the dysfunctional family that's so, certain family members are so like flawed, but just hard edged and just will themselves and the people around them to gain success and money and land and stature. I think that's sort of like a through line through some of these novels where it's like, they're kind of bad people, but they're interesting, and they kind of.
But it's what?
That's kind of like the American story in a lot of ways, right?
That's the American story. What does it say? Are we part of the generation kind of like Peter McCullough. We're just in our heads. We're constantly like, oh, is this a good or bad person?
Well,
to the extent where we don't like act in the world. It's not like, it's like, okay, we're sitting back, we're judging everything, but what do you actually do? And Eli is like, did things in the world. That was, he didn't really care to read books or anything because it was all, it's like, what am I doing here? What am I doing with my life? He was a, and that's the frontier ethos. And then the next generation kind of inherits the goods and the wealth from that can-do ethos, but we sit back, like, judge it.
But I feel like every generation, like, they don't want to, no generation wants to really build off the previous one or two. Like, they don't want to follow in the footsteps of, for instance, like, the greatest, like, World War II. What happens 20 years later? It's the counterculture, you know, generation.
Sure, yeah.
It's Woodstock. It, those two generations are not that far apart.
Yeah.
Those are the children of baby, like the baby boomers, or they are the baby boomers. They're, you know, you get what I mean. And then it's, you know, you can't really predict, I feel like, what 20 years, 40 years. And you try to, and you try to have like, oh, I've set the foundation. And then every single time, the next one or two generations does something that you're like, that is not what we intended to do, right? That's not what we wanted. That's not what we set up. That's not what we fought wars for, all that kind of stuff. Every, that happens throughout American history, right?
All the time. But it, and
this book kind of hits at that. Like, it's fascinating. It's great drama that, you know, the colonel sets up this thing, this family, he's a figurehead. And then like, two, three, four generations later, it's now what he sort of probably envisioned. And that's makes for great literature, right?
Yep. That's history. That's how it works.
Mentioned the, it seems like, I couldn't get too much information about his next novel. He seems like a deliberate writer. He's surprisingly a lot younger than I thought he would be. He's like, late 40s, he might be getting close to 50. So he wrote this when he was our age.
Yeah.
Late 30s, which is...
Think about that.
Yeah. I think the book is called The City, but I could be wrong about that. And I saw a possible publication date of next year.
Next year. I heard him say in an interview I listened to that he should have it done by the end of this year. Being 20.
When that comes out, that will just be an auto reading it, right?
He's on our list of like him, David Mitchell, Dennis Lehane, like new book. We're all over it.
So that's, you know, only two novels in 15 years, but hopefully we get another one coming up. And definitely, I know The Sun has the TV show. I haven't seen it. I saw good reviews. I don't quite buy as Pierce Brosnan as Eli.
Oh, here's the thing. I watched the first season when it came, like 2017. So, you know, now I enjoyed it. And it kind of reading this a second time through now jogged my memory. Because in the show, they have to kind of do the Pierce Brosnan's a little too young. He's good in the role. You buy him as kind of a patriarch. But it is like he's a little too young to be, and they make Jeannie Peter's daughter, like they kind of condense things. It makes sense for the show, and it's a worthwhile show. The young Eli kid's good. Like the guy who plays Toshaway is good. It's like it's worth a watch, but it's different. The book's better because it just has more space to deal with things.
I was gonna say, The Sun's fantastic, but don't sleep on American Rust.
They're both great. Yeah. He's one of the better than the next generation of authors under Cormac McCarthy and Wendell Berry and all those people, Margaret Atwood.
I don't know what
the next generation below them.
I don't know who I'd really compare him to. Not to say that he's like completely unique, but I'm just blanking on like who, like a, because I don't really want to do the Cormac McCarthy just because, they're both Westerns and there's violence. Yeah.
He's contemporaries with Franzen. It's totally different genres, but he's of that Bret Easton Ellis.
You can make a connection of the fascination or the look at dysfunctional families or flawed families or, you know, power hungry families, however you want to say it.
Is Lionel Shriver American? She's Canadian.
I don't think she is.
But is that she's, generation of the? Yeah,
it's funny you mention her. I've been meaning to like nominate her because I enjoy her books. A lot of people hate her books because they're very like. I've read a couple of them, and she's one of those authors where I'm just like, I like her style, and I could understand how people could just absolutely hate her style.
Hey,
I kind of like that sometimes in an author where you're like, I jive with this. I know this is not everyone's cup of tea, but yeah. I'm glad this exists.
Okay. Hey, I'll go along with it. Just don't do the We Need to Talk About Kevin. Any other of hers?
No, there's a book called Post-Birthday World that I read that if you look it up on, you know, Goodreads or stuff, you'll find like really negative reviews. Love the book. Loved it. But no, we need to talk about Kevin. I read that book. It's extremely depressing.
I know. Any other one than that, and I'll be on board.
Okay. Yeah. I'll just say, if we ever do a teacher, she's not everyone's cup of tea. Some people get really angry with their books. I don't know why. I didn't know that. I thought she was universally praised. I don't know how we got off on this tangent.
But. What are you going to do? A fun little side project. The next generation under the old guys. The big American authors in that generation.
Yeah, so.
Let me see. Favorite scene? Do you have a favorite scene?
That opening scene is just absolutely brutal and so perfectly done.
Mm-hmm.
It's really impressive. If you can write that scene like once in your career, you're doing something like
the Comanche raid.
Yeah, the Comanche raid.
Eli's kidnapped.
And hey, even the other scene too, where they basically brutally murder a whole family for no real reason. You know,
they want their land on a pretext.
They killed, you know, the women and children and all that kind of stuff. That scene is brutal. Like those back is just like,
yeah,
just like, wow. It's just powerful writing. So I wouldn't say like quote unquote my favorite, but I was most impressed by those two.
Do you think Eli's mom did it on purpose? She's out on the frontier. It's Comanche territory. It's full moon. And she cooks this huge feast.
No.
I think Eli reminisces. She's like, I think Eli thinks she did. He hints at it. But I think so. I think it's second time through. I kind of was like, I think she does it. As not like she knows it'll happen, but kind of throwing caution. If it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
I think she's upset with her husband. I think she found out Eli's father had a mistress tucked away somewhere. And she's kind of tired of living there. And she just throws caution in the wind. And in frontier Comanche territory, she just cooks this huge feast and the smell will waft away forever. She's kind of like inviting her own doom.
It
fits in, but it's fascinating. I think that the character is.
Talk about a time and place where you do not want to go back to and live. Yeah, I would get absolutely murdered.
It's so dangerous. That's why they were giving away land for free.
Yeah, like,
you're probably
no thank you. Thank you. I do not need to go see Amarillo. I don't think they got that far west, but they go to New Mexico.
Austin, huh?
They go to New Mexico, but just it's just hot wind. Even if you get some land, it's really hard to like maintain that land.
Wasn't there something appealing about in the Comanche when Eli's with the Comanches? There's something appealing about that freedom to be able to go anywhere. And you got your group of people. You're not in danger. You're a danger to others. You're not in danger like the frontiers people were, where you're in a settled house and people could come raid you. But just kind of riding around, hunting.
This is going to sound really basic. This is not what the book was supposed to be like. This is not what you're supposed to take from the book. I mean, it prefaces this all that. But reading the Comanche stuff, it's just like, gosh, the Comanches were cool. Just riding around on horses, just being absolutely, oh man, they did brutal stuff. But I'm just like, man, they're vicious, great warriors, and it's just like, wow.
You ride 100 miles overnight. You can track
just the tracking and all the stuff and all the stuff they did, and then all that is taken out by a disease, right? or just
yep, just
and it's like, wow.
Because Eli wouldn't have gone back had the Z's not wiped out the Comanches. He would have been a Comanche for
He would have. Forever. Yeah. And yeah. Anyway. No, it's high recommend. Glad we added it and can't wait. Hopefully we get a new Philip Meyer book in 2024. And when that comes out, and hopefully that does come out, because you know books can kind of get delayed, or you know, hopefully we didn't just jinx it and whatnot, but we will definitely be reading that on the podcast. So
yep.
Matt, any final observations, thoughts? What we got coming up? We got a lot more books coming up. We got to read some baseball books. We got Wendell Berry coming up.
Jaber's coming up. I think we'll pick our legal thriller
over on the legal Patreon. Stuff over on Patreon. Our Patreon's good. I just posted a new library report. I read a couple books and I talked about them over there. Nothing, a couple recommends, but nothing, you know, mind blowing, I would say. I read a 600-page Irish book that I thought was just fine, which is probably damning it with faint praise, is how I would describe that. But I did pick up the new Zadie Smith, just came out. And that has also been getting some mixed reviews. So I've read White Teeth, I've read Swing Time, which I didn't like very much. But
I was going to say, I haven't read any of hers since White Teeth.
White Teeth is very good.
White Teeth is good. I like White Teeth a lot.
Yeah. So,
well, hey, we'll pick a scary book for October.
What if I don't nominate scary books for October?
We got to pick a scary book. You want me to just nominate six and we choose? Because
I had this inkling, or kind of this itch, to kind of go back. You kind of mentioned it kind of briefly, like these sort of important American authors from the last 20 years. I've read some of their books, but not all. Definitely not all. Just like a book here and there. Maybe we should read more of those. But I know we got to read a scary book. I know that's the
very thing. Scary. And it can
I mean, I was thinking, you know, books like Middlesex, Freedom, Shabon, you know, we talked about The Amazing Adventures of Kevlar and Clay. I'm just looking at my bookcase where I've somehow grouped them all together. Maybe
yeah, they won't get picked, but that's something to do November, December. I'm just saying. Well, you remember how I got all weird last month and I nominated those big academic books you wouldn't want? That's because I wanted you to win September so I could turn around and we do my
scary. So I can maybe go, I could throw October.
Throw it.
But talk about it. You talked about interesting books, but just, I know you weren't going to pick those books. You knew we were going to pick those books. Maybe I go, I'll figure out something.
So. Tune in to see what we do with our October book selection.
And let us know, your thoughts on Philip Meyer. I hope the Sun's pretty well known. It's a pretty popular book, turned into a TV show, but,
it's good. Like I
said, American Rust. Definitely. It's probably not as good as The Sun, but I would say it's pretty close.
We don't need to pit them against each other. They're worth reading.
There you go.
Worth reading.
Good point, Matt. So, a lot of good books upcoming on our TBR. Also, check us out on Patreon. Also, give us feedback on Instagram. Communicate with Matt on Twitter or X or whatever it's called.
We're calling it Twitter. I'm not going to call it
Twitter, whatever it's called.
Yeah, I'll post a picture of the couch I saw it in half.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm not kidding. That wasn't a bit. I really did.
Not a bit. Like you saw the couch in half.
A real Eli McCullough type American for a good half an hour after I saw the couch in half.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.